All right, everybody, welcome back to the Fitz News Studio for this week's edition of the Week in Review. We've got a ton of Murdoch news to cover, folks. It was a huge week on the Murdoch murders, crime, and corruption front. Major developments in the federal case marking a significant escalation in that investigation. We're going to tell you all about it, exactly what happened, why it's important. We've also got a Cheer Incorporated update. Ali Benevento, one of the attorneys with the Strom Law Firm, came into the studio this week. She talked to us about that issue, but she also got into a bigger discussion with me about the issue of judicial reform in South Carolina, something that this news outlet has been covering extensively for some time. We're going to hear from Ali and show you some clips from that exchange. And last but not least, we're going to dive into the organized labor issue in South Carolina, particularly Starbucks. And we're going to have some interesting segments on this show, folks, with some, dare we say, risque drinks, Dylan Nolan? That's right. We got them right here. We're going to tell you all about that and why I'm guzzling this delicious confection here on your Week in Review. All right, so if you tuned into last week's show, you know that the Murdoch murders, crime, and corruption saga got short shrift on that edition of the Week in Review, but Murdochs are back with a vengeance this week, folks. Huge news in the story. A major escalation of this saga that has been dominating headlines across the Palmetto State and beyond for the better part of the last year and a half. We are now dealing with a major escalation of the federal case. And again, most of the action on the Murdoch story has been criminal in nature. It has been confined to the state court system. Okay, we're talking about the double homicide trial involving Alec Murdoch, who stands accused of killing his wife, his younger son, at the family's hunting property. We're talking about the obstruction of justice investigation into a boat crash involving the late Paul Murdoch, who was one of the victims of that homicide. We're talking about the financial crimes investigation, in which Alec Murdoch and a group of accomplices are accused of ripping off former clients of Murdoch's at the PMPED law firm of nearly $10 million. That's one of the big investigations we're looking at. But also there was the bizarre Labor Day shooting last fall where Murdoch allegedly conspired with one of his accomplices, Eddie Smith, to kill him. That was the idea. A botched suicide attempt is what we originally referred to it. According to law enforcement, it was a failed insurance scam that was intended to route $10 million to Murdoch's son, Buster Murdoch. But just a huge maze of alleged criminality that revolves around this man. And from the beginning of this story, since we started covering it over a year ago, from the beginning of this story, the biggest question that everyone who follows this has been asking is, how is all this just linked to one guy, right? How is one guy at the center of all of this criminality? And again, we don't even know the half of it, folks. If you read our news outlet long enough, if you followed our coverage long enough, you know that there is a drug angle to this, particularly not just the charges Murdoch's already facing related to drugs, but the potential for a smuggling connection, given one of his former colleagues, the late Barrett Bowler. That's a part of this story that continues to just hang out there. And everyone keeps wondering, how is all this being undertaken, implemented, engineered, orchestrated, pulled off by one guy? Well, It's not. And we know that now. And we know that particularly in the state cases where two other individuals have been indicted. I'm talking about attorney Corey Fleming out of Beaufort, South Carolina, and Russell Lafitte, who was the former CEO of the Palmetto State Bank. We're about to talk about them in a big way, people, but hang on to that. Hang on to that for a second. Those two have already been charged at the state level, and Lafitte has been charged at the federal level. He's the only one charged federally thus far in connection with this case. But isn't it bigger than that? I mean, again, three people, none of whom have come off in the public vetting process since they've been charged as particularly bright, okay? Are these three stooges the masterminds of this multi-layered, multi-year criminal conspiracy? I don't think so. I've never thought so. People covering this case closely, whether in the mainstream media, on podcasts, you name it, no one's buying it. That this is just a simple, you know, these three doofuses orchestrating these incredibly complicated scams. And also, let's look at the institutions which were propping them up, which is what we're getting ready to get into, folks. I'm talking about Palmetto State Bank. And I'm talking about the former PMPED law firm, which conveniently changed its name and rebranded in the aftermath of this Murdoch saga. But let's talk about those guys for a minute. PMPED, the law firm, as you well know, was where Murdoch practiced. It's where his father, Randolph Murdoch III, the former 14th Circuit solicitor, practiced. And it's where his brother, Randy Murdoch, Randolph Murdoch IV, still practices. Again, after they conveniently changed their name. But this is a firm that wielded tremendous influence in the South Carolina Lowcountry, this five-county region, the 14th Circuit. And again, three Murdochs served as solicitor down there for a period of over 80 years, beginning back in 1920. And Alec Murdoch, at the time all of these crimes were committed, these alleged crimes, rather, was a badge-carrying member of this solicitor's office. So the new solicitor actually hired Murdoch as one of his assistant solicitors. He's walking around carrying a badge for these guys. So you got this huge network of power, and you've got these massive abuses of that power regarding settlements, which some of the most vulnerable people among us, I'm talking about Hakeem Pinckney, a guy, you know, deaf, suffered catastrophic injuries in a car wreck. We're talking about underage relatives of Pinckney. We're talking about other underage survivors of these horrible tragedies that placed their trust in Murdoch, placed their trust in his firm, placed their trust in Russell Lafitte and Palmetto State Bank to handle their interests, to protect their money. Well, that didn't happen, folks. Not only did they not protect it, they robbed them. Then they started robbing from Peter to pay Paul, robbing one account to pay another account. It was just a Ponzi scheme of massive proportions where settlements were raided and then proceeds used to pay off other settlements. But again, up to this point, folks, up to this week, we have been convinced that's just a few bad apples. It was just Alec Murdoch and, you know, Russell scheming. They came up with this plot. They were able to pull it off because people were just didn't notice it, didn't have time to spot it. Well, guess what? We know now that is not true. In fact, I think we've known it all along that that's not true, but now we've got proof. And I want to talk about that briefly because last week, my news outlet reported on some developments in the federal case. Again, if you recall, Russell Lafitte's the only person charged federally right now, charged with multiple wire fraud, misappropriation of bank funds, six different charges he's currently facing. But among those charges are allegations that he took settlement money that was intended for particular victims, and he used it to pay back, again, other settlement funds that were raided, and used it to pay not only Murdoch, but according to the very latest developments in this case, others at Murdoch's law firm. And not only that, a huge check was written to Murdoch's law firm in the aftermath of all these crimes to allegedly cover the money they lost during these fleecings. Now, this is a huge development. You ask me, where are we getting this? Well, not pulling it out of our backsides, people. And we're not just quoting from court documents where one person says one thing and another says another thing. Because guess what? This week we found out that somebody in this case has receipts. Somebody in this case has actual evidence which implicates, again, this broader network that we have known from the beginning was there. But we are now beginning to see the outlines of it. And I want to talk specifically about what happened this week. We filed a big report this week detailing the federal prosecution of Lafitte, which again is the only federal investigation into the Murdoch scandal right now. But one of the questions that I raised in that report was very simple. Are the feds intent on pursuing comprehensive justice in this case? In other words, are they truly committed to getting to the bottom of this? Or is their investigation just a rush to find a fall guy, to pin the blame on that guy, Russell Lafitte, as a way of delaying, of misdirecting, and of ultimately distracting, taking the attention off of the people who were truly responsible for it? And I think we're seeing, folks, this week, I think we're seeing the answer to that question may be number two. Maybe that second option. And again, we don't know for sure yet. My hope is that the federal authorities are preparing a slew of indictments against multiple co-conspirators in this saga. And I'm talking multiple officials at Palmetto State Bank and perhaps multiple other attorneys and staffers at the PMPD law firm. Because what we found this week, if this recording that Russell Lafitte claims to have made of his colleagues at Palmetto State Bank, a private meeting of the board of directors at Palmetto State Bank, which he surreptitiously recorded, which is legal in South Carolina. South Carolina is a one-party consent state, folks. I could be recording this whole thing right now. Y'all would never know. I'm not, by the way. Dylan's recording it. He's the guilty party. But he can tape, and he doesn't have to tell them. And on that recording, we are told the specific details of a $680,000 check to the PMPD law firm were discussed. And not only were they discussed, but Lafitte was instructed on how to cut this check and disperse these monies without him or the bank being held liable. Folks, if that's not a broader conspiracy in this case, I don't know what it is. And it is amazing to me and it is disturbing to me that federal prosecutors in this case seem to be not only reluctant to hear it, not only reluctant to investigate it, but this entire hearing was kept offline, folks. We reported on it exclusively that this hearing was being held about this controversial recording in the offices of Judge Richard Gergel down there in Charleston, U.S. District Court Judge. Gergel never published the hearing, at least not until after it happened. And again, I'm going to get into the stunning lack of transparency here later, but this is the biggest criminal investigation in South Carolina history, folks. And we've got prosecutors and judges playing fast and loose with it. And not only are they playing fast and loose with it, they're doing it at a time where we are literally at a pivotal moment in this case where evidence is emerging, which implicates, again, not just these three stooges, not just these three doofuses, but an entire network, folks. It's the time that transparency needs to be at a maximum, okay? Not at a minimum, not these secretive hearings. Again, thank God we reported on it, or else who knows what could have happened? This could have completely flown under the radar. And again, that begs a larger question. Are these people committed to finding out what happened here, or are they covering ass for these powerful institutions in South Carolina? If you recall, we've addressed it here on this show. There's a push by the Palmetto State legal community, the Trial Lawyers Association, the bar, powerful people. They want you to believe this is just one guy, one bad apple. Guess what, folks? We are starting to see that it's not. We are starting to see what we have known all along, that this is a massive conspiracy involving numerous individuals at multiple institutions, and we don't even know the half of it yet. I keep saying that about this story, but it bears repeating. We don't even know the half of it yet. Now, if you read Fitz News this week, you learned a lot about that $680,000 check. You learned a lot about the network that funneled that money back and forth. You learned a lot about who was really responsible for that check being cut, about which settlement it rated, which settlement it was paying money into, which lawyers got how much money. But count on this. There is so much more. We have just started to pull that thread, folks. Our researcher, Jen Wood, has been diving into these transcripts, diving into affidavits, diving into deposition testimony. Russell Lafitte has laid this all out for us, people. From the very beginning, he said it. Wasn't just me. And guess what? Sounds like he's got the receipts. And if he does, and if he brings this home, we are going to see, hopefully, a level of accountability that we have not seen thus far in this case. And I want to, just before we go on the Murdochs, I want to close on one thing related to that. One thing that I think is very important. Last fall, I published two articles which detailed significant conflicts of interest in the U.S. Attorney's Office. And I'm talking about an attorney who was related to one of Murdoch's law partners, who works in the office where Murdoch was a badge-carrying solicitor. What's she doing in the courtroom? She was in the courtroom for one of Russell Lafitte's appearances. sitting on the prosecution side. What is she doing there? It's a total breach of ethics. Then another attorney in that same office was Murdoch's lawyer in a civil case related to these very crimes. And yet they don't think those are conflicts. I said last fall that this case should be moved out of the Charleston office. And in fact, you know what? I think that at this point, the Department of Justice needs to send attorneys from D.C. or from another state in to handle this case. Because it seems abundantly clear to me, again, unless there is something brewing behind the scenes that I don't know about, it seems abundantly clear that the conflicts that Fitz News reported on exclusively last fall are impacting this investigation, that are influencing it, and that are steering it in directions away from where it needs to go. I hope that's not true. I pray that's not true for all the victims of this case and for public faith in this institution, in the justice system here in our state. I pray it's not true, but the more we learn, the more it looks like it is true, folks. All right, we got one more bit of Murdoch news before we go. I forgot to mention this in our earlier segment, but I wanted to throw this out there. There's another little bit of Murdoch news from the civil case. And I'm talking about efforts by Greg Parker. If you follow Fitz News, you know this guy. This is the guy who has been implicated in the wrongful death lawsuit, going back to that 2019 boat crash in which Paul Murdoch, allegedly driving the boat that crashed into the bridge down there in Beaufort County, killed 19-year-old Mallory Beach. Her body found 5 days later after that crash. Parker's convenience store is where Paul Murdoch allegedly purchased some of the alcohol. Actually, it's not alleged. They got him on camera buying it, but used his brother's fake ID. So they've been implicated in that story. But Greg Parker has launched into a jihad, folks. He doesn't want to have to pay his share of this thing. And you know what? We've argued in the past, he's got a fair argument about what his share should be. Okay? That's a fair argument. But this guy's tactics in getting to that point have been reprehensible. I'm talking about leaking photos of Beach's dead body. Just horrible stuff that people allegedly in his employ have pumped out there into the bloodstream. Just horrible stuff. But this week, Parker's attorneys filed a motion to get Mark Tinsley, the attorney for the Beach family, kicked off the case. And their logic is pretty simple. Their logic is that Tinsley can't be an attorney and a witness in the same case. And let me explain real quick. Obviously, Tinsley is representing the Beach family in that wrongful death case. Doing a heck of a job, by the way. Just recently won a big ruling. Got a judge to reconsider one of his prior orders that hardly ever happens, which was a big win for the Beach family. But Parker wants him off the case, so he's filed this motion, and he's claimed that he's a witness to the case because of a conversation he had with a reporter by the name of Vicky Ward. And again, Ward, one of the documentarians that's been covering this story, helped produce a documentary on it on Discovery, I believe it was. But there's a key conversation in which she alleged that some of the material that she used for that was purchased from Parker's, from people in Parker's employ. And she allegedly said that to Tinsley, and Tinsley, we're told, has made it clear that's what she said, and now Parker's is saying you can't testify to that in this case if you're also going to be an attorney. Now, here's the problem. We are told, we've been talking a lot about recordings in this episode, we're told there is a recording of that conversation between Ward and Tinsley. So once again, folks, just like on the criminal side, here we are on the civil side. Somebody's got receipts. Somebody's got receipts, and we're going to find out as that case progresses who's got them. Now, we're told that that hearing on whether or not Tinsley should be kicked off the case probably not going to be held until November. But once again, keep it tuned to Fitz News for the very latest, not only on everything happening on the criminal side, but again, the latest developments on the civil side of this Murdoch Murders crime and corruption saga. All right, so obviously a lot going on in the Murdoch case this week, but the Cheer Incorporated scandal still rolling. We had an interview this week with Allie Benevento. If you've been following this story, you know Allie well. She's one of the attorneys with the Strom Law Firm. That's the firm that's filed several of the civil cases, the RICO cases, related to the Cheer Incorporated scandal. They filed lawsuits in South Carolina and in Tennessee. Allie came by the studio to visit us, and we were talking about another subject, but before we got into that with Allie, we addressed the very latest on the Cheer Inc. saga. Here's what she had to tell us.
So Again, our allegations in this complaint are that from the top all the way down, that there was a concerted effort on behalf of coaches, gym owners, the oversight agencies, Varsity, Jeff Webb, working together in an organized way to create an atmosphere where they were accepting money from these children's parents for them to participate in cheer, promising safety to these athletes, promising a safe environment to these parents who were entrusting their children, but then creating an atmosphere not only where the abuse could take place, but once they knew abuse was taking place, they were working very hard to protect the brand, right? To protect their profit margin. Because what happens if it gets out that gyms are unsafe or coach so-and-so is an abuser and he's been moved from gym one to gym two? Well, there's everything leads back to Varsity, right? Everything's under that Varsity umbrella. So it's bad for business. Child sex abuse is bad for business, right? It's bad for, and if it's bad for business, they could potentially lose money. And so the allegation is that they created an atmosphere where this was allowed to continue. They protected themselves. They protected their profit margin, all at the expense of children. Meanwhile, dozens and dozens of children were being sexually, physically, emotionally abused.
And,
they did nothing about it.
You talked about that revenue stream, obviously coming from the parents, but some of the individuals accused of abuse are, I guess they call them cheerlebrities, who are very well known within the industry, who are also bringing millions of dollars to Varsity. Is that correct?
That's right. So they are putting these cheerleaders, these athletes, on a pedestal and giving them this celebrity or cheerlebrity status. These young people are on social media promoting themselves, promoting the brand. A lot of them are Varsity ambassadors. They'll have the little link on their social media account that says, click here and purchase whatever. We can only assume that they're getting something in exchange for that. You'll see Varsity, USASF, these other entities liking and sharing and on their posts, and they are promoting these athletes to try to recruit younger athletes to have somebody to look up to. And what we found in our investigation is that oftentimes, well, I mean, look at Jerry Harris. He was a cheerlebrity. Look at Nick Frizzell that we just named in our Tennessee lawsuit. He was a cheerlebrity. That they are using these athletes and their status to entice younger athletes to participate, you know, further in the sport, to get close to them, to look up to them, to trust them. And that's how that cycle of abuse starts, with that invitation for trust, that invitation for adoration. You know, these are people they look up to. Again, like in the cheer world, they're celebrities. It seems kind of silly to somebody like you or me, right? Like, who cares? These kids care. It's a big deal. It's their whole lives. And so when they see somebody who is like a god in their sport, and all of a sudden that person starts paying them attention or giving them compliments or giving them adoration, they think that, like, oh my God, wow, this is really special. And that's how that creepy cycle of trust that leads to abuse begins oftentimes.
That attention is intoxicating.
Yeah.
All right. So that was Allie Benevento from the Strom Law Firm providing us with an update on the Cheer Incorporated saga. That reminds me, if you haven't checked it out yet, folks, Cheer Incorporated, our podcast on Apple, on Spotify, wherever you download your podcasts. Folks, we put a lot of effort into this. And our research director, Jen Wood, who narrates Cheer Incorporated, it's just done an amazing job talking to the victims and survivors of this story, who are now starting to tell their stories. And they're telling them exclusively on Fitz News and on Cheer Incorporated, folks, because they know that we will get their voice out there and we will tell their stories the right way. So if you haven't listened yet, it's incredibly gripping stuff, incredibly poignant stuff. Cheer Incorporated, the podcast on Apple, Spotify. Please listen to it, but also if you like it, review it, share it with a friend. Anything you can do to spread that story, the victims and survivors of this case will be grateful. But the Cheer Incorporated story, believe it or not, that's not the reason Allie came into the studio this week, folks. She actually came in because if you follow this news outlet, you know that I've expended a lot of my spleen on South Carolina's judicial system, justice system, or rather the lack of justice that's inherent in that system from my perspective. I've been pretty outspoken on this issue. And this past week, we had a case that I was very outspoken about. A judge down in Charleston, Bentley Price, who last month led a serial abuser of women, a guy with multiple DV convictions, domestic violence convictions, who was involved in some just harrowing attacks. Again, after the previous convictions, prosecutors and victims requested a sentence of between 6 and 10 years, which, based on the facts of these cases, based on the previous offenses of this individual, Casey Lee Combs is his name, that seemed a reasonable sentence. But guess what? Bentley Price let this guy go. Folks, let this guy go. Suspended his sentence to probation. Let him walk out of the courtroom. So I kicked him in the balls a little bit on the site. And then some lawmakers decided that they were upset with that and decided to criticize Fitz News. And guess what? We found out one of those lawmakers had received some very favorable rulings from the judge. So we kicked that guy into balls too, right? It's kind of what we do here is tenderize the testicles of those who deserve it, right? But Allie views this from a different perspective. And again, she's got some fair points. And one of the things about Fitz News is that while we do tenderize testicles from time to time, we like to bring people in. I'm laughing at this whole tenderizing thing. It's pretty funny, right? But we like to bring people in who have different vantage points, who have different perspectives, because this mic, all of our mics, are open. You don't like what we say? Come on. It's yours. So we had Allie in the studio this week, and I'm telling you, I know I'm right on this issue, and I know that she's not right, but watching this debate, I pretty much got spanked. And so I wanted to cut to a clip of this because even though she's coming from a different angle and an angle I don't necessarily agree with, Allie did an amazing job articulating her views. Let's cut real quick to a segment from that exchange.
Again, I've been a broken record for years on South Carolina's judicial branch. And again, if you read Fitz News, you're very familiar. I've always said that the system is corrupt, it's broken, that powerful lawyer legislators manipulate it for the benefit of their clients. But you're here to say that none of that's true, correct?
I don't know that I'm here to say none of that's true. I'm here because I think that the conversation is deeper and wider than maybe you've given it credit for. There are problems, no doubt. Okay, the system's not perfect. And the system in South Carolina by which we appoint judges or elect judges is not perfect. And I know you hate it. And that's fine. And there will always be abuses and there will always be problems. But what I have not seen you do in articles or in talking or just in conversations with you about the problem, what I have not seen you do is kind of look a little bit deeper. So, yes, the judges are front and center, right? They're the ones out there with this target on their back, visible to the public, story in the newspaper. Here's Judge so-and-so given, you know, this criminal a slap on the wrist.
Hold on a sec, Allie. Okay. Let's I don't want to disrupt your train of thought, sure. But they're not. Unless it's on Fitz News, who's calling them out? They're not getting called out in the state or the Post and Courier or the Greenville News or on the nightly newscast. Who's calling them out other than me?
If you want to have that, you can.
Okay. I'm sorry. But you're right. They are the ones who are visible making the decisions.
They're most visible. And let me just start by saying that I work with these judges on a daily basis. I get to know a lot of them personally. A lot of them have been around for a lot of years. And as a general rule, and I would say pretty much across the board, I can't think of a single one in South Carolina that I would say this doesn't apply to. These are good, decent, hardworking people that want to do the right thing. These are people who could make a hell of a lot more money working in private practice as lawyers, but have instead chosen the route of public service. And what I don't believe, what I refuse to believe, is that we have judges in South Carolina who are beholden to the legislatures that appoint them to their positions, to the point that they will violate the judicial oath that they take when they take office. And at the expense of their licenses, their careers, their reputations. That I refuse to believe. Mm-hmm. Now, are there problems? Of course there are problems. Are there certain cases that you might pick on or write an article about that don't seem quite right to us? Of course. Yes, at first glance. Something like with what you wrote about Judge Price the other day, for example, that gentleman that I think had multiple issues going on with some domestic violence charges. What I'm trying to do is to say, let's stop. Let's take a deeper look. Let's widen the camera lens a little bit and let's stop focusing so much on the little tiny bit that we see and ask the questions about what else is going on, what else is at play, because there are problems, again, and they're deeper, they're wider, they're more complicated, they're more nuanced than you're giving it credit for. We don't have judges running amok doing the bidding of legislatures all over the state. I don't believe that.
Okay.
I don't believe that. I think that we have good, hardworking judges that are doing the best they can with what they're handed. And I'm going to pick on everybody a little bit for a second, okay? But I'm also going to give everybody a little bit of credit. So let's take, for example, the issue of judges who let someone out on bond when maybe that person is accused of a violent crime, okay? Who's prosecuting that case? An assistant solicitor in some circuit, right? Who, again, for the most part, are good, hardworking people who have gone into public service for a reason, okay? And for the most part, prosecutors across the state, I work with these people every day, have good relationships with them. These are good, hardworking people that want to do the right thing, that want to do justice, okay? Who's giving them those cases to prosecute? Law enforcement, police officers, who, again, are there just like there might be a few judges who, and I'm not saying in South Carolina, but in general, could a judge potentially be corrupt? Of course he or she could, just like a prosecutor could be corrupt. Back up. Who hands the prosecutors the cases? Police. Mm-hmm. Are there bad police officers? Sure, because good police officers will tell you there are bad police officers, and hopefully they distance themselves from them. But for the most part, are the police trying to do the right thing? Are they getting up in the morning trying to do a job and to do it well and to keep the community safe? I think so. Mm-hmm. I do. Okay. Are there systemic problems that feed into the policing problem that we have in America? Yes, you might disagree with me on that, but I believe there are. But for the most part, okay, let's take that those groups of people, okay? Let's take law enforcement who originate these criminal cases. Let's take the prosecutors who then have to take them to court. And then let's take judges who have to ultimately do something with it, okay? Mm-hmm. There may be times where law enforcement does a sloppy job, or they might cut corners, or they just might not have information available to them that might make the case a little bit better. And that may be through no fault of their own. But they're going to hand that case to the prosecutor, and they're going to say, here you go, prosecute this case. That prosecutor might look at that case and be like, man, this thing is kind of a steaming pile of you know what. I don't know what I'm supposed to do with this. What's that prosecutor going to do? Let me stick that to the side, and maybe we'll deal with that later, right? So what happens? Let's not forget that in this entire process, there's a person, okay? That person might be an accused criminal, but it's a person, okay? Let's say it's your brother, okay? I don't even know if you have a brother.
I do.
Okay, let's say it's your brother who's accused of a violent crime. That case, maybe the prosecutor sees a few problems with it. He or she's going to set it to the side and nothing's going to happen with it. Your brother doesn't get a bond initially, so he's sitting in jail. Mm-hmm. Months pass. Sometimes years pass. Let's say your brother doesn't have a job. He doesn't have money. He doesn't have a family. You don't want to bail him out because you don't like him very much, okay? And he's just sitting there in jail. And this case gets to be 6 months old, and then a year old, and then 18 months old. And then your brother's public defender might say, listen, I'm trying to get something done in this case. This guy either needs to go to trial or you need to let him out of jail. He can't sit here this whole time. He hasn't even had a trial yet. We don't even know if he's guilty of this thing that we've accused him of doing. And so that lawyer might file a motion to set bond. And then who gets it? The judge. The judge doesn't know anything about this case, okay? Contrary to what maybe the public will believe, the judge doesn't get a copy of the file to read through what's going on. The judge takes a seat on the bench and says, okay, there's a motion on the docket for bond. Mr. Solicitor, Madam Defense Attorney, tell me what this is all about. And then he hears the case and decides, should that person get a bond? Well, here's the conundrum. The judge might say, well, this person's accused of a violent crime. What does that judge have to balance? The judge has to balance the risk that that person would flee and not show up to court and the danger to the public and letting this person out, but also has to balance the fact that this person has not been found guilty. This is not a punitive incarceration at this point. This is pretrial detention. So he's got to balance all those interests and say, you know, why hasn't this case gone to trial? Well, who makes that decision? Well, that's kind of complicated, right? But the solicitor, maybe. I mean, it is. It's complicated. Docket control. That's a totally separate issue for another day. The judge might look at the prosecutor and say, is the state ready for trial? And in the back of that prosecutor's mind, they're like, man, law enforcement handed me this steaming pile of you-know-what. What the hell am I supposed to do with this case? Judge, we're not ready for trial. And, you know, maybe the prosecutor's waiting on information from law enforcement. Maybe law enforcement's waiting on information from elsewhere. You know, again, there are layers to this. And so this is why I'm saying don't just look at the one little piece involving the judge. There are layers to all of this. So when the prosecutor says we're not ready for trial, what is the judge supposed to do? Just say, well, that's okay. We can hold this innocent until and unless proven guilty person in jail in perpetuity until what? Until the prosecutor decides that they're going to pick up that steaming pile of you-know-what and take it to trial, or maybe they're going to dismiss it, or maybe they're going to make a plea offer. Mm-hmm. What is the judge going to do? So maybe the judge sets a bond, and maybe the bond's set at $50,000, $75,000. Well, if you've got money, you can pay that. If you don't, you can't. That's a separate issue. But then what's the paper going to do? What's Fitz News going to do to that judge? They're going to say, look at Judge so-and-so letting an accused murderer out on the street. But what has the paper, what has Fitz News not taken into account? Haven't backed up to all of the other entities that play a role in why we got to where we got, why that judge was handed something and asked to do something with it that he knew a whole lot of nothing about, was not privy to all of the background information, and only has the question of if this case, you know, if the prosecution's not ready to go to trial, then that judge is going to say, okay, then the remedy is to let this person out on bond. You can't just hold people in pretrial detention into perpetuity and not make a move. Somebody has to make a move. And if the prosecutor's not going to make the move for whatever reason, and I'm not knocking the prosecutors. Listen, the docket is a disaster, and they have more cases that they can handle than they can handle. But when the judge gets that, you know, and we're vilifying the judge for doing his or her job, we're not being honest about the entire picture. We're not being honest about the full problem.
That's fair.
Yeah.
All right. Once again, I want to thank Allie Benevento from the Strom Firm for coming in and sharing her perspectives on that. And again, folks, these mics are always open. Whether you agree with us, whether you disagree with us, whether you want to slam us, tenderize our testicles, hey, we're open for it. Because again, that's why we're here, to host that conversation. The open microphone principle, the marketplace of ideas, that's always the way we're going to approach it at Fitz News. That reminds me, be on the lookout in the next couple weeks. Allie and I are going to be back on camera with some special guests, dig even deeper into that injustice system in South Carolina and talk about what kind of reforms, if any, need to be made to that system. So look for that segment again in the coming weeks on Fitz News. All right, so if you follow Fitz News on Twitter, you know that I'm a bit of a coffee snob, but you also know that I love to support local coffee shops. And we've got a great one here in Irmo, South Carolina, where we're based, Loveland Coffee. If you've never been there, got to check it out. It's amazing. But we love to support those small businesses because, again, we believe that that's where jobs are created in South Carolina. Small businesses are the engine of job creation in the Palmetto State, so Fitz News likes to support them. But the other reason, I got to be honest, I just don't like Starbucks. I've never liked it. Coffee tastes acidic to me. It's got kind of a bitter aftertaste. And in fact, there may be a reason for that. Let's cut to this clip.
Starbucks has figured out that people tend to like semen that's produced by the testicle glands of a man. So what's the big deal? If they mix milk and semen together, makes for some people a nice taste. Now, I don't go to Starbucks. I don't drink coffee, first of all. But when I said that, I know they're not going to air that. I know they're not going to edit it. I know they're going to put that on the air. They're not going to do that. But don't argue with me. Don't you argue with me. Milk, mammary glands, semen, testicle glands, both are naturally produced by the body, and a lot of people tend to like them. So Starbucks has figured it out. So they blend a little semen synthetic with their synthetic blends of milk. And people drink Starbucks coffee. I don't. And I will not. And I advise you, don't drink it either.
Tastes fine to me. Pretty good. So for those of you who are listening on the podcast, I literally just downed half of this Venti Mocha Frappuccino from Starbucks. It was flavored deliciously, dare I say, but If you're wondering why we're talking about this, why we're looking at this issue this week, I'll tell you. It's because Starbucks has become ground zero in a major unionization push here in South Carolina. And I know you're probably thinking, wait a minute, unions in South Carolina, that doesn't really fit, and you'd be right. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, South Carolina has the smallest unionized percentage of its workforce of any state in the country. Literally, unions are worse off here than in any other state. And frankly, that doesn't bother me because, again, while I'm not unsympathetic to the plight of the proletariat, I got to tell you, these Starbucks workers, they're not making their case very well. Just last week, when Hurricane Ian hit South Carolina, they went on strike demanding catastrophe pay during this hurricane. And again, these are workers in the Midlands region of the state. I'm not talking about the coast where there was actually some damage, obviously nothing like what happened in Florida, but there was some property damage on the coast from Hurricane Ian when it hit South Carolina. But the Midlands, I mean, seriously, 30-mile-an-hour winds, and these people want catastrophe pay? I mean, I was out in those winds, people posted. So they weren't that bad. I mean, seriously, I didn't demand catastrophe pay from Fitz News, or maybe they could pay me in these venti mochas. God, Dylan, these are so good. Must be that secret ingredient. But anyway, we're going to continue to follow that unionization issue because it goes directly to the heart of South Carolina's competitiveness as a state. And again, if you think that right-to-work status is something that's good, I happen to believe that it is. Again, we welcome you here to discuss that side of the issue. If you think unionization is good, we'd love to get those Starbucks baristas in here and see what they think about it. And maybe we'll share some of this with them, see what they think about that catastrophe pay issue. But again, on the issues that matter to South Carolina's economy, count on Fitz News to keep you up to speed on them, and not only up to speed on them, but to bring you that incisive commentary and that kind of take that you just don't get on the mainstream news. And with that, I'm going to dive back in to this delicious Frappuccino. I can't get enough of this stuff, people. That's a wrap for this edition of the Week in Review. If I make it through this, I'll be back next week where we bring you the very latest on all the news and events impacting the state of South Carolina. Thanks again for tuning in. We will catch you next time.